Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
And I'll tell you something else, too, is I cannot stand sissies.
You're going to talk about wrestling, that's redneck talk.
Hey everybody, welcome to Dragon King Carl Classic Wrestling Audio Show here at WrestlingObserver.com, Figure4Online.com. I'm your host, Carl Stern. Thanks a lot for listening to the show. And I'm kind of doing a marathon session of recording today. Work has been a little bit hectic. I actually, for the first time in God knows when, picking up a little overtime. So my recording schedule has been a little whack, and so today I'm doing several Dragon King Dark shows and some biography shows that will air in July, and we're going to do this show, this regular edition. We're going to do the mailbag today, and let me encourage you, if you have questions to send in for the mailbag, then by all means, please do so, because I'm going to try my best to run the gambit of them today and get the majority of the ones I have left out of the way. This show is a listener participation show. That means you, the listener, create the content. You do so by sending topic suggestions, follow-ups, just whatever dealing with classic old-school pro wrestling to the following email address. It is very simply carl@dragonkingcarl.com. That is Carl with the letter K, K-A-R-L@dragonkingcarl.com. And I will get to that. It doesn't have to be a question. It doesn't have to be, hey, what was the circumstances behind, you know, this situation or whatever. Those are great. Those are fine. But you can follow up on what other people send in. You can follow up on topics we've talked about. If you've never heard us talk about something here on the show, by all means, suggest it, and we'll be glad to. I'm producing a lot more content than I used to between this and the Dragon King Dark show. Over on Dragon King Dark, I'm using a lot of the music stuff over there and stuff related to that that used to kind of cover off topic. Well, now I've got a whole show where I can do stuff that fits that genre here, but from time to time we'll do off topic here as well, and that's fine too. So I guess let's just dive right into the email and talk about things as they come along. I'm just trying to think if I got anything off the top of my head that needs discussed as far as pending stuff. I'm sure there is. I'm just drawing a blank right now. Let's just get into it. Oh, the last show, by the way, I realized it did not record in stereo. That was a fault of mine. If this show runs the way it's recorded now, the file size is bigger. It's better quality. I've got it trimmed down as best I can. But if I run over an hour just a tiny bit, the file's too large to upload to F4W. And I've asked, you know, can we please increase that? And I think there are some technological limitations on doing that at the size I'm recording in. So what I have to do is I have to take it through another bit of software and kind of downsize it, compress it down some. And that usually works great, no problem, but I have to manually set it to go to stereo on this software. And I just forgot. So it's a problem. It's a fault of my own, nobody else's, and I apologize for that. But to avoid doing that, because I hate having to do that to begin with, we're going to try to keep our shows now around 40 to 45 minutes before the bumpers I put in, and that should get it fairly close to an hour, just under. So we're going to keep trying that, and I hope that works. All right, let's see here. Let's jump right in and see what we have here. Brant says, I have another random question for you. In the past, you have used a rock punk type song for some of your between segment breaks. If I remember the song lists a lot of territorial wrestlers. I remember Ric Flair specifically, maybe Dusty Lawler, and seemed to be singing about their angles. Does this ring a bell? Like I said, originally heard it as a between song segment. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think you are thinking about a song that was done for Memphis Wrestling that was put together. I'm trying to find it right here. I'll put the one in. I think it is, if I can find it here. Let's see here. It was, gosh, I don't remember what the name of it is. I'm going to have to scroll through the songs to find it. But if it's the one I'm thinking of, it was one of those Jerry Lawler, Jimmy Hart deals where they found somebody to do a offbeat, wacky song about that. So I think that's the one it was. And I will try to find that and put that in as the bumper for the next segment. If that's it, then I will follow up next show on it because I mixed these in last. And just off the top of my head, I don't see it listed. I don't remember what I had it named as. It was something weird. It was just a terrible song, by the way. I thought so. But it was a band. I got it off of YouTube, so I'm sure it's on there. And once I find it, it will be there. I know this is riveting radio, but I'm going back trying to just see if I just by chance see it. And I don't, because, again, I don't have no memory of what I named it. But I will try to find it and put it in the bumper for this show. Yeah, again, I've run back through the list here, and it didn't jump out at me, but I'll try to find it for you and put it on there. Okay, let's see here. This is from our good friend Jason Campbell of ProWrestlingHistory.com, and as always, I want to encourage you to check out ProWrestlingHistory.com if you have the opportunity to, because of the awesome wrestling history that's involved there. We'd been talking about Jim Lundos and his drawing power, and it came up over the course of a few shows, and here's what Jason has to say. The biggest draws discussion from your recent show was interesting. I look at the biggest draws a little differently than the writer who was questioning Jim Lundos' drawing power. The comparison should be how cards drew that person versus those in the same city without them, or in more modern times, pay-per-views with them or without them. In Lundos' time, there weren't many arenas that held more than 10,000 people. The population was much smaller, travel was more difficult, and disposable income wasn't what it is today. Additionally, cities were run much more regularly in the past, most cities being weekly or biweekly. Today, you may hit a city three times per year at most and are mostly in the larger markets. If we just look at dollars, modern wrestlers far outdraw those from the past for the reasons mentioned above. Steve Austin may be the biggest draw. He wasn't on top as long as Hulk Hogan, but his peak was higher than Hulk Hogan's, and they had monthly pay-per-views. John Cena's been the top WWE guy for a long time, but the numbers are nowhere near Hulk Hogan or Steve Austin, and you have the brand argument, being that the brand is what draws the WWE name and brand more so than individual wrestlers. Jason goes on to say, but comparing how well a city drew with and without specific wrestlers is a little harder. A lot of pre-World War II newspaper results I've found don't list attendances. It is often a general statement about a big crowd, the best of the season, or a disappointing number of fans. Jim Lundos is usually mentioned as having drawn a large crowd, but you often saw this with the other world champions. Frank Gotch drew very well for his time period, as did Ed Strangler Lewis. However, Jim Lundos drew crowds of 25,000 or more, at least reported as such, around a dozen times in a period where that wasn't very common. How many modern wrestlers can say that? And the big U.S. cards were in the middle of the Great Depression. I have no idea what Greece's economy was like at that time or even how accurate the crowd estimates are, but they were still huge numbers. In using the with versus without criteria, There are quite a few other people we could look at, but many of them didn't have the 10-plus year run that Jim Lundos had. The best name I could come up with is Buddy Rogers, who drew very well in the 1950s and early 1960s wherever he went. There are others in discussion like Dusty Rhodes in the 1970s and early 80s, Jerry Lawler also during the 70s and early 80s, 1974 being an amazing 8,000 plus per week in Memphis, The Sheik in the 1960s and 70s, and Antonio Inoki and Giant Baba in the 70s and 80s. And how about Andre the Giant? He was a big attraction, but had the advantage of not staying in the same territory for very long. And none of them were long-term world champions. Well, Buddy Rogers for a couple years. I'm guessing there are some candidates from Mexico like El Santo or Mil Mascaras. I'm sure there are others worthy of discussion like Whipper Billy Watson, Eduardo Carpentier, Antonino Rocca, Ivan Robert, Carlos Colon, and others that I'm missing. On a related topic, what wrestler has performed in front of the most number of fans over the course of their career? An interesting question like number of matches and ring time. I'd guess it would be a big name that spent most of their career from the 50s through the 80s. Crowds were a lot bigger than the pre-TV era, and they generally worked a lot more than guys did from the 90s until now. You would think it would tie the most number of matches, but some, like a traveling world champion or a WWF wrestler, would have a big advantage due to the size of the markets they worked. I'd put Bruno Sammartino, Andre the Giant, and Lou Thesz near the top of the list. I think Matt Farmer maintains a list of crowds that were over 10,000, so he may have some insight. So that's a great commentary from historian Jason Campbell. Thank you very much for that. I would also add Ric Flair and Antonio Inoki to that list based on, you know, the longevity of both. The big North Korea shows that drew well in excess of 100,000 people legitimately, although, you know, not by choice, a kind of a captive audience, but nevertheless, legit 100,000 plus crowd. All those Tokyo domes Antonio Inoki worked at. The length of Inoki's career, he's got to be up there. Ric Flair, too, is a traveling champion, although, you know, so many Ric Flair shows took place on smaller circuits. I mean, if he headlined in Birmingham, Alabama, and they had a sellout, you're only talking about 5,000 or so people. Then he might go to Kansas City, where it might again be under 10,000, and then he might go to Dallas, Texas, where it might be under 15,000. But still, it was, you know, regular multi-time a week, and that's going to add up. Then when you start throwing in 100,000-plus numbers at least a couple times, all the WrestleManias he appeared on with giant crowds, Flair's got to be up there pretty high in terms of a wrestler who's appeared in front of the most number of people. That's pretty big. So again, I'd love, you know, it's one of those things that somebody someday is going to, I guess, have to get down and really crunch the numbers on. But thanks a lot, Jason, for that tremendous email and follow-up to that discussion. And that's what I'm talking about by following up on these. Love to have everybody follow up on some more of these. This is from Brandon, and Brandon says, I have a follow-up question. This is regarding the history of kayfabe. We talked about this several shows ago in relation to an earlier question he asked. He says, what do you think was the last pro wrestling match that was a major money-drawing main event that was a complete shoot and was known by both wrestlers going in that the match would, in fact, be a shoot? For example, the Frank Gotch versus George Hackenschmidt matches were shoots in this sense, correct? But there were matches after their series that were major bouts that drew large numbers, say, at least in several thousands of fans, right? I'm asking because I'm working on an article about the UFC and WWE and numerous brushes with promoting shoots that WWE has had over the years and the stars who have crossed over between the two companies, and I think information about the last time a big shoot was promoted as a pro wrestling match would be a good opening for the article. That's a great question. I would think the women's match between who was it, Byers and Mildred Burke, that was a shoot, and that was in the 50s. But going over to just, you know, main event men's wrestling world championship type matches, Not the 1920 match with Joe Stecker and Earl Caddick that we've talked about many times here on the show. Clearly a shoot from watching the tape. And that's pretty late in the game for a straight up going into the match shoot. Now, there are lots of double crosses after that, clearly. I mean, many double crosses after that. But, you know, when you say the criteria is the both people went in the ring knowing this was a legitimate contest in wrestling, you may be hard-pressed to find one after the Caddick-Stecker match that was a big, as you said, you know, major money-drawing main event. That was a complete shoot, and that was there at Madison Square Garden. I would think it would probably be it. You know, there is actually some skepticism about the Gotch-Hackenschmidt matches. I know Crimson Mask over at Wrestling Classics has often stated some degree of skepticism. Now, we don't have video of it. We know it was taped. We know it was videotaped. There are pictures of video cameras there. Tapes never come up. Tape is likely never to come up because of what it was filmed on. The type film, silver or something or another, was notoriously unstable and didn't have a long life. So even if somewhere in an attic somewhere somebody has, you know, real footage of Gotch Hackenschmidt, is likely unrecoverable. But we do have photographs from that matchup, and there's something about that that he takes as them working loose and stuff. And I've saw the photographs too, and you know it. I see what he's talking about, and I don't necessarily dispute that there are some red flags there. I still lean. I'm 90% sure Frank Gotch, George Hackenschmidt, both matches were shoots. But I also understand the skepticism. I understand the skepticism. It's there are some legitimate questions that can be asked about it. So we'll leave that as it is. But perhaps there's some later than Caddick and Stecker. Probably something obvious that's on the tip of my tongue that I can't think of right now, but I would say probably that. But great question, great follow-up. This is from Rob over in the UK, and Rob says, one of the subjects of pro wrestling history that I feel doesn't get covered enough is referees. For every great match, there's always a third guy in there, and if he gets it totally wrong, it could ruin the whole thing. Maybe the guy's just incompetent. Maybe he's been paid off. So I'm thinking of the Hulk Hogan, Sting, Nick Patrick situation here, allegedly. But that's the modern era. I'm more interested in looking back to the pioneer days. How were referees assigned to matches like Frank Gotch and George Hackenschmidt? Were there a commission in those days, or did the camps have to agree? What about when people went abroad? Did they take officials with them, or did the host country supply them? I think that's enough questions for now. As always, I love the show, and I encourage people to buy the Stern Sticks. Awesome content, great, great value. Well, thanks a lot, Rob. I really do appreciate that. And if you're interested in the Super Stern Stick, 14-gigabyte flash drive, please go check out my website, DragonKingCarl.com. There's over, there's right about 500 MP3s on there dealing with pro wrestling history, all kinds of stuff. There's series on there, like a history of the NWA World Title, a history of wrestling series, history of pro wrestling action figures. There's lots and lots of mailbag shows. There's all kinds of stuff. But not only that, there's over 500 PDFs that you can read about old wrestling newsletters, martial arts. There's martial arts booklets on there and stuff. There's all kinds of stuff. Look, it's tens of thousands of match results, just photos, it's all kinds of, it's really a huge collection of pro wrestling history that people have used this, the stuff off there, to build websites with, to write books off of, newspaper articles. Some of the stuff in back in the past was used, especially from those old Dragon King Press newsletters that are on there in PDF form. Those were used at one time by USA Today and Fox News and ESPN on some stories they did. And Lance Pugmire from over at the Los Angeles Times called me up one time, got some of that stuff I had and used that in some stories he was doing. So all that stuff's on there. If you're interested, I would really appreciate it. It's only $20 with free shipping anywhere on earth. So go check it out. It's over at DragonKingCarl.com, and I appreciate it. And Rob, to get to your question, it's a great question because it was really a mixture of things. Yes, there were definitely state athletic commissions. Most famously, the New York State Athletic Commission really had its hand in boxing and wrestling. In fact, the president of the New York State Athletic Commission for a long time was William Muldoon, the Pioneer Era wrestler, who kind of swapped over from wrestling to boxing as his kind of his favorite thing after retiring from wrestling there in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And he lived to be up in his 80s and was still, you know, involved with the New York State Athletic Commission. So a lot of that, even I think even as late as like Gotch Hackenschmidt, William Muldoon had some input into. And they, you know, sometimes it was a state athletic commission. Usually it was boxing referees and stuff like that. But honestly, some of it was retired wrestlers, injured wrestlers, and things like that, which, of course, opened the door for corruption, especially when you're talking about something that is being bet on heavily. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, several of the early, and I can't remember the guy who was the referee for the Gotch Hackenschmidt matches. I think it was two different guys, but Gotch's matches several times were refereed by lighter weight wrestlers or wrestlers who were out with injuries and stuff that were, you know, part of these groups. And a lot of times it was agreed on by the different camps. Sometimes the ridiculous police gazette, the National Police Gazette, might appoint a referee for some silly thing they were doing. And look, we've got to do a show on the National Police Gazette sometime. I highly encourage you to Google up National Police Gazette and have some fun with that because it was quite the thing. But it was very influential in the early days of wrestling. It really was. It was really something else. But that's a great question, and the answer is there's no simple answer to it. It was all across the board. And a lot of these camps that would barnstorm, well, of course, they would carry their own referees with them. And most of the time, they were other wrestlers. Sometimes they were, otherwise somehow involved in the carnival or the troop or whatever. With state athletic commissions, they were often, boxing, wrestling, whatever, whatever other sports the commission oversaw. Hey, it just kind of like today, you'd have states that didn't even have an athletic commission. You'd have other states that were very influential, like New York, like Nevada nowadays. And then you'd have some that was just like, you know, Texas that would, you know, heaven only knew what they would do. You know, they were just out there doing their own thing. So, again, it was a very eclectic mix of things. All right, let's take our mid-show break right here. And when we come back, we'll hit a few more questions. I don't think, again, I'm going to be able to finish. I'm looking, and I still have several more questions to get to. But, again, if you didn't hear your question on this show, it's because there's still some questions in the email bag. Go ahead and still send in questions anyway. I'm on a tear of doing shows right now, so let's get as many of them in as we can. And again, the email address is carl@dragonkingcarl.com, Carl letter K, K-A-R-L @dragonkingcarl.com. Go to my website, dragonkingcarl.com, if you're interested in Super Stern Stick. And follow me on Twitter. I am Dragon King Carl. All right, let's take a break right here. And if I can find that song we talked about, I'll use it. And when we come back, we'll hit some more email questions right after this.
Oh, Terry. Oh, Terry. Blabbering and blubbering and bawling. He looks like Bob Barker.
The drugged man.
So far up his poo-poo.
E-A-R.
Finality.
He's got to be some kind of a pervert. He's got Alzheimer's disease.
And blew that jackass's brains out. Daddy! Daddy, why did you do that to my jackass?
Are you a sissy?
Filthy and ugly slime balls.
And I had a jackass, and I loved that jackass.
Should be locked up for being a pervert. All he wants to do is look at the fat, ugly, greasy broads that are sitting at ringside.
Sissies.
You yellow pig! Pig!
Hey, no!
Pig!
Hey, no!
Pig!
No!
Pig!
Hey, no!
Yellow pig!
Are you a sissy?
Finality. An idiot to your stinking, absurd, lower-class town.
Oh, Terry. Oh, Terry.
All right, we're back for the second half of the show. And here's a great question from Travel, because it's something, it's one of my favorite guys in wrestling is involved in this, and it's something I too have wondered about and tried to do some research on, try to get to the bottom of. Not a real clear-cut answer, but I'll give you my thoughts on it. Travel says, what is the real reason Bill Eady of Demolition Axe, Mass Superstar, is completely ignored for the WWE Hall of Fame? There has to be something going on there. I just heard this week they're putting in Big Boss Man. Hey, as far as WWE Hall of Fame standards go, he's a great candidate. He was one of those guys everyone in the 1980s knew about and had a huge money feud with Hulk Hogan. I just keep wondering why in the heck Demolition keeps getting ignored. Perhaps there are some 1980s stories that can shed light on this. Gosh, if half of the WWE's current audience is guys and gals who watched the 1980s wrestling, they would be very happy to see Demolition. And I completely agree with you, Travel. They are still, I think to this day, the longest reigning WWE World Tag Team Champions. If not, they're still very high on the list. Again, held the belts longest period of time. You would think that's something WWE would put in. Bill Eady had a great run in WWE, WWF. Before Demolition, he was a very, he was kind of like Kim Patera level guy for people like Bob Backlund and early days of Hulk Hogan when he was the Masked Superstar. He was even considered for the Iron Sheik's role as being the transitional champion between Backlund and Hogan. He was definitely a guy that was in there. He worked with, he worked on and off with all the major champions in the 1970s into the early 1980s. Of course, he was big in Japan. He worked various territories. I mean, he was a fantastic masked heel, one of the most recognizable masked wrestlers in the United States easily, and maybe even Japan also. When he transitioned out of that role into Demolition Axe, of course, he, along with Barry Darsaw, who was Crusher Khrushchev previous to that, had a great run. Now, they were absolutely Road Warrior knockoffs. Don't let anybody fool you. I don't care how they try to explain their way out of it. They were Road Warriors 2.0, but they were different enough that it worked. And they were an excellent team, a very good team. And certainly very recognizable from the 1980s. And their theme song, that Demolition theme song with, who was the guy that did that? Rick Derringer. Rick Derringer's song, the Demolition theme song, was, very memorable. Who doesn't remember the Demolition theme song? Great. One of the best, in-house produced wrestling theme songs maybe there's ever been. So, yes, there's definitely more to the story. Now, in light of the other people that they've made peace with over the years, like superstar Billy Graham and Bruno Sammartino, guys who have clearly had major issues with WWE, that have been Ultimate Warrior, have been brought back in the fold, it seems relatively minor when it comes to Bill Eady. But for whatever reason, there's just been, it doesn't seem to have been made up for. Bill Eady and Randy Colley, the Moondog Rex, were the original Demolition. Okay. They took Moondog Rex and he was the first smash. And that didn't last much beyond one TV taping and a couple house shows before they pulled him out and put Barry Darsaw in. Because some smart fans there seen him, he was recognizable, they were chanting Moondog at him, and they decided they wanted to do something else, and they put Kali under a mask for a little bit of time before he was finally just kind of let go. And Edie and Darsaw went on to become the more famous, well-known and tag team champion Demolition. Well, it has been argued that it was Randy Colley that came up with the idea. Now, Randy Colley went on the territorial scene after this as Detroit Demolition. He worked Memphis and Continental under that gimmick, wearing the Demolition outfit as Detroit Demolition. And one has to ask themselves, how did he get away with that? Well, the answer is because he may very well have come up with that. That might have been his gimmick, and there was litigation over it. And Bill Edie was involved in that litigation over that gimmick. So perhaps there's bad feelings there that have never gotten covered back up. Because after Bill Edie ultimately left WWF, that was pretty much it for him. I mean, he did independent work for a long time, but that was his last time on a big main stage. And he's not one of those guys they ever have brought back regularly. When they have brought back Barry Darsaw, they brought him back in as the Demolition, as the Repo Man. When they did the gimmick Battle Royal and stuff, you would have thought that would have. And Bill Edie was doing independent shows at this time. You would have thought that would have been a perfect time to have brought Demolition back in to do something, you know, to put over a new tag team, if just to come in and endorse them. But we've never got that Demolition reunion. We've never got any. They're seldom ever even referred to. If you watch any of the WWE documentaries and stuff, very seldom is Demolition even referred to. And I think it's kind of a weird thing. Randy Savage was so high profile and so, you know, pop culturally relevant that when they kind of ignored him out of history, it was on everybody's mind, everybody's tongue. For some reason, Demolition's been done the same way, but I guess they were far enough down the card that not such a big deal has been made out of it. I mean, Randy Savage, clearly a bigger deal than Demolition. But they've got kind of the same treatment where they've just been ignored. And I think it is to Bill Edie, not Barry Darsaw, because he has been brought back a few times to reprise the Repo Man. And I think he's even done I know he's done some commentary on some of the WWE biographies. He was on the Road Warrior one where they talked about him. He may have been on some others while Bill Edie has not been. So really, it is a mystery, and your guess is as good as mine if perhaps they're still mad at him over that lawsuit, even though they ended up making peace with other people that have sued them in a big way, like Jesse the Body Ventura. And Ultimate Warrior. I mean, how many lawsuits did Ultimate Warrior have against him? So, yes, very interesting, and it's a great question. Demolition absolutely deserves to be in the WWE Hall of Fame, and their place in history needs to be preserved, and it's, I think, a pretty big injustice that it's not being. But the only thing I know of is that lawsuit. And I don't even know how that turned out. Something, clearly, nothing was ever done about Randy Colley using Detroit Demolition gimmick. They've used the Demolition has reformed on the independent circuit, especially like they still go around today as Demolition doing signings and stuff. So it looks like they won that. And maybe there's something over that that prohibits WWE from even acknowledging them or whatever. So, but it is really weird situation, and it is very perplexing. Travel goes on to say, so the story goes, if WrestleMania 1 is a financial flop, WWF goes out of business. Mr. T is what made it a money maker. I know from the Observer that Mr. T was considering backing out just days before the show. So let's say Mr. T pulls out and WrestleMania is a failure and Vince has to go bankrupt. What are your thoughts on how wrestling would have unfolded after that? I would assume Crockett goes on to dominate. However, their push to be national was in response to the WWF, as well as other territories trying to go national or even renaming their territories. So if the territories were not dealing with WWF and didn't need national expansion to survive, would we still have them today? would they still have imploded or tried to go with a WWF style of plan and go national and try to destroy one another? Please discuss how things may have unfolded if WWF went under in 1985. And that's a great question. I actually think it would have, it would not have went down anything like that. Let's say WrestleMania 1 is a huge flop, and Vince McMahon does, for whatever reason, have to declare bankruptcy. I don't think that's the end of the Vince McMahon story, because what does Vince McMahon do? He just goes home and retires. Well, we know that's not Vince. That's not how that happens. I think somehow, some way, he gets investments, he gets investors, he perhaps even buys into another existing promotion. With all the bad blood and AWA being near death at that point in time, I don't think it would have been AWA. I don't think it would have been Crockett, who was pretty strong up to that point still. I think he would have restarted something new. I think he would have, maybe folded Titan. I don't remember if it was Capital Sports or Titan at the time was the name of it, but that would have went bankrupt. But I think he would have started his something else and picked back up some of those deals. Now, he would have struggled certainly very, very hard if he couldn't get the same amount of money in he had to work off of before. But I think Vince would have found a way to make it work. What it would have done was set everything back a lot. I don't think any group would have went on to national domination. I think Crockett would have remained the strongest up until the point they were spinning themselves into the grave. And they would have still, I don't think it would have made any difference to Crockett. I think he still spins himself out by 89 or 90, still ultimately ends up selling to Ted Turner. So I think the WCW-NWA story doesn't end any differently than it did. AWA, perhaps they stay around a little longer, perhaps. But I actually think it's going to leave a void that Vince McMahon himself is going to refill with some other new company. It's just going to slow the progress of everything. That's how I think it ends up going. If for some reason, let's say you're right, and WWF, Vince McMahon is completely taken out of it. For whatever thing, he decides to go into, the circus or something. He decides to completely go away from wrestling, and Vince McMahon's no longer has any impact in there. Wrestling struggles. I really think it struggles. It doesn't get that national exposure. What happens, I think, maybe what happens to Hulk Hogan, because he is by this point in time a big pop culture star. Maybe he goes completely into acting. Maybe he goes to Japan to complement his his whatever movies he's making. I don't think he goes like back to the AWA. I don't think he goes to Crockett, but I think whatever the future of wrestling would have been would have followed whatever Hulk Hogan did next. He was the big deal, and he was certainly leaning toward. I mean, he did A-Team with Mr. T. Of course, Rocky III had already been made at this point, but then he starts making those B movies and stuff. Maybe it changes the whole trajectory of what he does in life, and I think maybe that's something to look. Maybe he goes somewhere you totally didn't expect. Maybe Hogan goes back to Florida, of all places. And Florida is really struggling at this point, but they revamp themselves. Vince McMahon, maybe what if Vince McMahon and Hulk Hogan jointly buy into Florida, rebranded as something more national, and grow it from there? I mean, that's not beyond the bounds of possibility that something like that could happen. So who knows? The answer is who knows. But certainly, man, wrestling history would have been enormously different had that taken place. Okay, this one has several parts to it. This is from Dave, not the Dave. This is from different Dave. This Dave says, listen to your show today and want to make some follow-up comments and questions to add to your list. You discussed promoting your own wrestling shows. Did you ever have one that was a financial flop and you couldn't pay your wrestlers the night of the show? If so, what happened? Further to that topic, which promoters were the worst at payoffs to their wrestlers and did it lead to any violence or legal actions? Oh, gosh. Most of the shows were financial flops. Most of them, it seemed like you barely covered cost. The way it kind of worked is the way I did it, that was the least disastrous kind of way of doing it. I don't know anybody that really made money promoting wrestling on the independent scene, but you would book your main event, and that would be two known guys. Let's say it's Bob Armstrong against, Iron Sheik or something like that. So that would be your biggest expense usually. So you would try to sell enough tickets, have enough money up front to pay those guys. Then the rest of your card would be filled out with local or, you know, really true indie wrestlers, and they would get paid really whatever you had left. And it would depend. They might get $10. They might get 50, just depending on how well the show did. And so it would kind of that you would take up the difference with those guys. There were many times that we didn't sell enough tickets to cover the cost, and you just have to take that bite. I mean, you just have to go to the ATM in your own bank account and get out enough to pay whatever. You know, you owed, and that happened a couple times. And you would try to, if you ever had a successful show, you'd do your best to stick some of that back because the next one might not be. And fortunately, I didn't do that full time. I promoted only a handful of shows. Would not be something I could have done full time because the money just wasn't there. To do it, even if you had a good sized crowd, a good house, man, that next one may eat you up. And you try to get guys who, again, you know, I go back to talking about Mike Jackson, I'm going to be talking more about him in the future too, by the way, just a hint there. He's a guy that didn't cost that much to use, but he would get out there and work himself. I mean, he would go to the Piggly Wigglies, the Walmarts, the dollar stores, whatever, and, you know, hawk his stuff. And, I mean, he was worth whatever you paid for him. While you would have other guys who maybe had been on, like, back then, here's what you had a lot of. You had guys who were not under exclusive contract to WCW, but they might have been on Nitro a few weeks ago. And so they had some notoriety, but they could do independent shows too. And if you could get those guys relatively reasonable, you could advertise like, you know, Gentleman Ken Timms, who might have a little bit of name value from his time in Continental, versus WCW Nitro star Hector Guerrero. And Hector would be working, you know, Nitro and Thunder and Saturday Night and would be at least getting TV exposure and stuff and would be relatively reasonable on his payoff. And so you'd kind of get that. You just sort of worked, you know, whatever worked. But I mean, you know, then there were all your local favorites. So it didn't matter if they hadn't been on TV in 10 years. People knew them and wanted to see them, like Bob Armstrong and Tommy Rich and, well, any of the Armstrong brothers and Bill Dundee and people like that. So it was really, you had to put a lot of thought into it, had to really mind your P's and Q's and watch what money you spent, or you absolutely could end up in a bind. Dave goes on to say, I was recently thinking about Muhammad Ali doing wrestling matches. His Antonio Inoki one where he got his legs brutalized is pretty famous. Honestly, it was terrible sportsmanship for Inoki to lie on his back like that and just kick all night, a real embarrassment for Muhammad Ali. The other one I know about is his altercation with Gorilla Monsoon. From what I saw of it, Monsoon gave him an airplane spin and basically made fun of him afterwards. Said, why would Muhammad Ali agree to do something like that when he's still active in his career as a boxer? Also, were there any other events Ali got physically involved in wrestling matches or angles? There's a lot to talk about there. And I will go ahead and tell you that one of the biographies I'm going to do in July is actually going to be on Muhammad Ali. I had a request from that a few months ago. And I thought, well, you know, It's going to be hard to get to him because he wasn't a full-time wrestler, but I am going to do that in July for the reasons you brought up. So I'm going to answer most of those in depth during that show, but just to hit a few of your points, it wasn't poor sportsmanship by Inoki. If anybody got screwed in that match, it was Antonio Inoki because they came in at the end and changed all kinds of rules on him, basically preventing Inoki from doing any kind of wrestling, and that's about all he could do. I mean, the rules that they come up with at the last minute is what shoehorned him into doing that. But we'll talk more about that when we do that show. There was the angle he did with Gorilla Monsoon, but I think Ali was a ham. Ali was very funny, and I think he saw it as just hijinks and tomfoolery, and he was a big wrestling fan, grew up watching wrestling, got a lot of his rap, so to speak, his interview style from wrestling, and so I think he would just love being there, just love doing it. And yes, Ali was involved in some other stuff, famously an angle at the Superdome for Mid-South Wrestling involving, of all people, the Snowman. And we'll definitely talk a lot about that. I'll give you something to look forward to coming up in July. Dave also goes on to say, what is the history of blading? When did guys first decide to intentionally cut themselves in order to get the match over to the crowd? Is there any consensus on when it started? And what would some of the earliest known blade jobs be? Also, the 70s seemed to be like a slasher flick. There were blood on every magazine cover, blood on every house show match everywhere. Guys were blading themselves 6 nights a week across the territories, and it seemed to never end. Why did they take it to the point that it was as commonplace as a clothesline? I think blading is a good thing to put over the right match at the right angle. However, the 70s took it to ridiculous proportions. And you're exactly right. You're pretty much spot on in exactly what you said there. The 60s, the 1960s, I don't really know of any blading incidents in the 50s that I'm aware of. That had to be a thing somebody come up with in the early 1960s. I'm betting you anything, you could trace this back to one of the Welches or Gulas, because this totally reeks of something they would come up with to add drama to a match and whatever. So it's weird. You would think the first time this happens, it would be very memorable. But it is quite hard to pin down. I'm saying at the earliest, the late 50s, not early 1960s, probably more so. And again, by the 70s and when everybody figured out, hey, this really brings in, you know, red turns to green, the old saying. Everybody was doing it and doing it too much. And I'm glad to see the blade go away. I do like blood and drama in a main event match where it's just, you know, two guys in a war. I don't like blading, though. I think it's 2016. That's just out, you know. So I don't know how you get around it. But I was always one of those guys. I liked, you know, a little bit of blood in the big matches. It just added to the drama, especially if it was a real war between, you know, a Rick Steamboat and a Harley Race or something like that. I think it really added to the drama. But come on, I mean, blading is so just no. So anyway, great question, though. Dave says, who has the worst forehead in wrestling history due to blading? Abdullah looks bad. However, I've seen a lot worse from the Sheik or a few Mexican wrestlers. New Jack, even Dusty was pretty bad. Had his careers over. I mean, I think most people would say Abdullah because they're so deep on his head. Of course, you know, the ones you brought up, the Sheik, Dusty Rhodes. I mean, gosh, in Mexico, I mean, what about Perro Aguayo, the father, senior, Perro Aguayo senior? And, yeah, I mean, there's some ridiculous foreheads in wrestling from that time period, to be sure. You discussed your next July marathon. It seems you will be doing wrestlers that made Carl Stern a fan or kept you into wrestling. That is absolutely correct. Will you be repeating any ones from last summer or by default excluding those guys from the list, even if some were part of your fandom? Yes, I will be excluding those. If I've already done a biography on them, I will not be doing another one. I guess we will be getting Jerry Stubbs, Austin Idol, the Armstrongs, and the Fullers. You are probably right on some of those. This is also, I believe, Adrian Streep spent time in your area. So if it happens to be part of your fandom, I'd love to get one on him. You'll probably not be disappointed. He was a fascinating guy, and I love how he combined the effeminate gimmick with being a legit tough guy. And he says, I believe he was a legit tough guy in real life, too. So most of the feminine characters were portrayed as weaker, cowardly, or outright jokes like Adrian Adonis in WWF. Lastly, Buddy Rose. If he had kept his weight down and had a better body, do you think he could have been a WWF or NWA world champion even for a short heel reign? He was such a great wrestler and talker, but as we got into the 80s, he just got so fat and he couldn't get that kind of national singles push. I know in the early 80s he had some great runs with Backlund, but was an afterthought the world title picture, that which I assume was due to his expanding body. Do you think he would have drawn as a heel world champion? Absolutely. If Buddy Rose could have got his body in shape, absolutely. Now, long-term world champion, no, but short-term, absolutely. Not just there, AWA also. I mean, he could have absolutely been a transitional guy, a pushed guy. When you go back to when Buddy Rose wasn't so terribly out of shape there in the Pacific Northwest, back in the days of, you know, Roddy Piper and that era, I mean, he was as good as anybody, and I think absolutely would have worked. He just let himself get so far gone. Well, thanks a lot, Dave. That was a tremendous email, and I really appreciate that. Well, I didn't get to everything. Knew I was afraid I wouldn't. I still got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Got about 10 or so left. So I apologize I didn't get to it. But we will get to, we'll start with those the next show. Please send in your emails to carl@dragonkingcarl.com. That's Carl, letter K, K-A-R-L @dragonkingcarl.com. Let me remind you again, if you're interested on the Super Stern Stick, which I talked about earlier, my website is dragonkingcarl.com. Please go check it out. $20 free shipping worldwide. And if you are so inclined, to follow me on Twitter as Dragon King Carl. All right, thanks a lot for listening to the show, and we'll be back very soon with another one.
Fast. From all parts of the world came the outstanding wrestlers in the business to challenge the Iowa Grappler. He defeated them all. For 10 years, he ruled as the wrestling champion of the entire world. And this was in the days when wrestling was a serious sport. Overall, Frank Gotch wrestled 400 bouts and lost just 6. As the idol of millions in the United States, Canada, and Mexico, Gotch made wrestling a big-time sport in his day. As a matter of fact, he drew larger crowds than did the heavyweight champion of boxing. By the time Frank was ready to return to his Iowa farm, he had earned millions of dollars. Added to that were the honors that Gotch had won over the years. Babies had been named in his honor, as had buildings, toys, farm implements, and 100 other things. The word Gotch was a synonym for quality and strength. And it is my opinion that a lot of these farm communities in Iowa and Minnesota, Kansas, Nebraska had many things in common. The difference is Iowa had Frank Gotch. You had that Babe Ruth figure, that larger-than-life figure that really, really inspired the younger people coming up. They wanted to be like Frank Gotch.